Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons are having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God bless the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has one matter on its afternoon submission docket. I'm glad all of this crowd wasn't trying to be here during the morning. Well, and it's Gulf States Utilities Company versus Public Utility Commission of Texas and others from Travis County. We have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner.
May I please report, Mr. Shannon Ratliff will present argument for petitioner.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. As incredible as it may sound, Gulf States Utilities is here 8 years after the entry of the order from which it appeals in this proceeding, and 10 years after the River Bend project began successfully generating power. It still seeks what this court spoke of in Coalition of Cities as a straightforward adjudication of its right to place the capital invested in River Bend in its rate base and earn a return on that invested capital. Instead of that result, what we are faced with and what we seek relief from this court with regard to is a Court of Appeals opinion, which we believe has converted Coalition of Cities into what purports, according to the Court of Appeals, to be a PUC decision to effectively permanently disallow $1.45 billion from the rate base of Gulf States. We submit to you that under the established jurisprudence of this court, that the appropriate interpretation of the PUC's order from which we appeal is based upon a review of that entire order. And from that entire order, it is clear that the Public Utility Commission sought to defer the question of prudence and the quantification of prudence with regard to the $1.45 billion until a later proceeding. It is true that there are findings in the order with regard to a determination of the burden of proof and GSU's discharge. However, when taken in full context of the order, it is clear that the Public Utility Commission was saying that neither GSU carried its burden to prove prudence, nor had the opponents carried their burden to demonstrate imprudence. Therefore, they specifically refused to disallow.
What is, Mr. Riley, if I guess this procedure is just not something I'm used to as a trial judge.
Yes, sir.
Are there overlapping burdens here? If the Coalition of Cities had not come forward to show imprudence, would Gulf States be entitled to include all those expenditures in this rate base?
Justice Ant, we believe that the way the burden operates is that Gulf States Utilities can discharge its burden of going forward, establishing a prima facie case, because of its rate filing package, which demonstrates the cost that it has invested in this plant, and along with its pre-file testimony, demonstrates at least for a prima facie basis the prudence. And we believe that this is consistent with the way the Commission has treated these matters both before and after Coalition of Cities. It is also clear from the order that we're looking at here that what the Commission said is Gulf States Utilities has the burden to prove those elements of cost which are reasonably challenged.
Now, do you have, okay, let's say you've got the burden at least facially to show that you've got it. Now, is the posture of this case where the PUC refused to make a ruling? Is that the posture of this case?
I think what the PUC did, Your Honor, you can, I suppose you can call it a refusal. I think what in fact it was, is it was a recognition that with the financial condition of GSU at that time, that a deferral was in the best interest of the public, the ratepayers, and the utility. And that what they were going to do was to analyze in more detail the 1.453. If you remember from this record, what happened was that there was a definitive cost estimate, which had primarily been used by GSU, or was primarily used in this hearing to determine whether GSU had been prudent in its restart decision to go ahead and construct this unit. In the course of this proceeding, that DCE was modified, and there was a determination at that time that those costs and the definitive cost estimate should be included in the rate base at this time. There was a further decision that they wanted more evidence. That
just, okay, let me.
Okay, I'm not focusing.
The facts of it, I'm familiar with where these two numbers came from, but
right.
I'm just more interested in the procedure. So now, does the PUC conclude the rate hearing?
They conclude this rate hearing, and they direct GSU to file a subsequent rate hearing, which was the subject matter of the Coalition of Cities opinion.
Okay. Now, but the Coalition of Cities basically says they can't do that.
The Coalition yesterday said they could not serve.
Okay. So is the posture now that we go back and order the PUC to now rule? I guess my question is this. If this had been a trial of a case, the evidence had been submitted, the evidence had been closed, and the judge comes up and says, well, I think you've made your burden on X issue, but you haven't made on Y issue, so I'm just not going to rule on Y issue, and now right. I'm going to render judgment. It would go up on appeal, and you sit there and say, well, judge, you've got to rule on that issue.
That's
so
correct.
You send it back. Is this a new hearing, or do we simply now command the PUC, decide, you know, tell us, do they get included or do they not get included? And then we come up and decide whether or not that decision has been based on substantial evidence. Is that the posture of this case or not?
I would differ with you in this regard. I think the appropriate order from this court would be that the error that occurred in this case requires a reversal and remand to the commission. For the reason that I think one of the vices in what we see here is that we have a court order coming along after the fact and creating a permanent disallowance. It seems to me these are matters that are constitutionally and statutorily committed to the PUC.
My question is, are you seeking a new hearing at which you would intend to introduce evidence of the prudency, or is the posture of the case not unlike us mandamusing a trial judge to rule who's otherwise refused to rule?
Well, I think that is a good analogy, except that I believe it does not recognize that it seems to me the more appropriate order is to say to the PUC, you are the experts in this area. You will determine whether there should be additional evidence adduced, whether you're going to decide it on the basis of the record that is before you with the correct understanding now of what you could and couldn't do. But I think implore the court that I believe it would not be an appropriate method of proceeding to simply say to the PUC, tell us whether you're going to include it or not, and then we'll decide whether it's supported. It seems to me what's more consistent with the framework is that it would be remanded to the PUC, and that agency would apply its expertise in determining what it thought was necessary.
Does a record support your content? I mean, it would seem to me that would be a viable solution if the hearing was somehow truncated or concluded prematurely, or is there any indication in the record that the PUC said, we just don't have time to hear all this, so let's go ahead and make a preliminary ruling and then we'll take that up later?
Well, I don't think there's anything that says we don't have time. I think there's plenty of stuff in the order where they say, like in their finding 164A, that it should be excluded from planning service at this time. They go on to say that a phase-in for rates that was going to be done over a period of time in order to avoid rate shock, that was unnecessary because they had determined that they were going to defer that issue, and it was unnecessary to address that at this time. So it is very clear, when you say truncated, it's hard to say that a 130-day hearing, I suppose, was truncated, but it is clear that the decision process did not carry all the way through, and that it is clear to me that the reason for that is because the commission believed it could do what this court said in Coalition it could not do.
Okay, let me be clear about it. This is not a situation where the trial judge says, I don't want to hear that because I'm not going to address it. Is this a situation where they heard it and said, well, we just can't make up our minds, so we're not going to decide it? Now, which situation is it?
I think it's the second situation.
In that situation, should our decision be to send it back and say, open it back up to more evidence, or should our decision say, PUC, you can't not decide that question just because you're not sure about it. You have to decide that question, and recognizing who has the respective burdens of proof.
I think the appropriate order is, PUC, you should decide this question, and you now understand you cannot decide it in bits and pieces, that you've got to make a decision with regard to prudence on all of the expenditures, and that you're not allowed simply to divide it. So I believe the correct order would be to remand it to the commission for its further consideration.
Questions?
Thank you,
Ron.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Stephen Barron and Mr. Jeffrey Day will present arguments and respondents. Mr. Barron will open the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm Steve Barron, representing the Public Utility Commission of Texas. I would like to note that Chairman Pat Wood and Commissioner Judy Walsh of the commission are in attendance in the courtroom this afternoon. Your Honors, River Bend, the evidence showed, was the fourth or fifth most expensive nuclear plant ever built in this country on a per kilowatt basis. The total cost for the plant was $4.5 billion. The definitive cost estimate that GSU submitted for the Commission's consideration was $1.73 billion. The hearing examiner, in the course of his 400-page examiner's report, stated the burden of proof issue in plain terms. GSU has the responsibility to explain why River Bend costs so much, and that accords exactly with the burden of proof provision in Section 40 of the Public Utility Regulatory Act. The hard truth is that after 132 days of hearings, at which this court found in the Coalition case, every issue had been exhaustively looked at, the Commission made a hard decision. It decided on the one hand that GSU had presented credible evidence and was persuasive to a certain point, but beyond that point was not persuasive at all. GSU's definitive cost estimate, as the chart indicates, the Commission found was professionally and thoroughly prepared, that GSU prudently relied upon it, and then beyond that, the Commission looked at evidence in other parts of the record and concluded that an additional more than $500 million should be added and considered to have been prudently incurred, and they found that the outside cost for River Bend would have been 2.273. But the definitive cost estimate was not the centerpiece of GSU's prudence case. The centerpiece, and that is the word of the hearing examiner, not mine, was this auditor's report, a PLG report. And here, the Commission reviewed it and found the report extremely superficial, very cursory, relying on a document in which categories were so broad as to be almost meaningless, offering no clue as to the reasonableness of changes. So I think on the burden of proof question, there's no doubt that once GSU came in and the evidence was looked at, that if there had been any presumption, which this court said there is not in Coalition simply by opening your books, that it shifted and GSU had the responsibility to explain why it cost so much. Now, the Commission's good faith reading of this court's opinion today and ever since 6 years ago when the opinion was issued is that the Commission made a decision, it made a call, and that although it believed incorrectly that it could not, that it could reexamine the issue. That was simply an error of law. The Commission found, having evaluated the evidence, that the 2.273 was prudent and should be in, but that GSU had not met its burden of proving that the amount above that was reasonably and prudently incurred, and the Commission concluded that that remainder, $1.453 billion of Riverbend costs, should not be included in GSU's rate base. That is what we read, the Coalition of Cities decision to say, is that in this proceeding, the underlying administrative appeal, the burden is on GSU to show that the PUC's order is not supported by substantial evidence. The question of whether the PUC issued a final order, which is what is being re-argued today, we believe was decided in the Coalition case. The underlying sentence identifying the remaining issue before the court today and before the Court of Appeals is omitted from the opening page 7 of GSU's application for writ of error. That is the key issue. And to put the issue more precisely, the issue is the Commission's determination that GSU failed to meet its burden of proof reasonably explained by evidence, substantial evidence in the record, and by adequate finding. And the Court of Appeals correctly found
that. That was a finding, but that was not a conclusion. The finding as to whether the burden had been met or not was not the conclusion that the Commission reached.
The Commission reached that very conclusion, that they had not met its burden.
It made that finding.
Yes.
But it was unwilling to draw the conclusion that finding entails. It expressly refused to draw that conclusion.
What our interpretation, Your Honor, is of this Court's decision is that, the very issue of whether the Commission reached its final decision or not was squarely joined as an issue in the Coalition case. And the majority found that the PUC had made a final decision by stating that GSU failed to meet its burden of proof on that prudence of the $1.45 billion, the PUC effectively disallowed that amount from rate base. The PUC order must be considered final unless it has the authority to defer, which the Court found it did not. The dissent disagreed. There's no doubt that this was an issue. The dissent urged that res judicata makes final a matter which has finally been adjudged, and that clearly a matter that was expressly reserved has not been decided.
But if a trial judge says, I'm going to render a take-nothing judgment against the plaintiff, and I think the plaintiff actually might be able to prove a case, and he can turn around and refile it tomorrow, I encourage him to do so and may be able to prove it. I'm not sure he's done it in this case, but I don't want to include that in this case. But I am going to render a take-nothing judgment. But I do that with the understanding that that doesn't cut him off.
If you apply that analogy, Your Honor, you undo the ruling that the Commission made a final decision, which is the underpinning for the res judicata holding that
the Commission clearly did not make a final decision. They expressly defer resolution of the prudency issue to another proceeding. Do you agree with that or not?
I agree that the Commission believed mistakenly that it had the authority, once it found GSU failed to meet its burden of proof, that it had the authority to re-examine the issue and let GSU have a second chance. And that's what was enjoined.
There's never been a final determination one way or the other in the previously of these expenditures, has there?
Your Honor, there has been a final determination as to what amount of costs GSU proved was prudent. It is true that there are not specific affirmative imprudence findings that detail every dollar that was not allowed in rate base.
The Commission's orders had a fundamental legal premise was wrong. You agree with that?
I agree that it was an incorrect error of law, but it did not have an effect on the rates that were set. What the Commission did, I think it's clear from the evidence and the findings, is in setting the rates, evaluated the credibility of the evidence and applied the legal standard of the prudence standard, what a reasonable manager would have done under a similar situation. And that's what set the level of rates, and that's what led the Commission to make its findings, finding of fact 237, that GSU was was to have invested capital and would have an opportunity to earn a reasonable return on its invested capital used and useful, and its conclusion of law 37, in which the rates set were just and reasonable. The district court, on the causation issue, the district court, I think, offered a good analogy to baseball, in which it likened the commission to the baseball umpire, in which the umpire watches a strike, watches a pitched ball, watches the strike, watches it, calls a strike, mistakenly thinking that there had only been one strike, and so didn't realize that there had been two strikes, and there was an unintended consequence for that. And when the matter is called to his attention, though, the call stands, because the issue of what set the rates was, if you, I can push the analogy, is whether the call was in the strike zone. The fact that it may have had there may have been a misconception about an unintended consequence didn't affect the commission's call of what the rates should be. What the
that's not quite the analogy. The analogy is the umpire says, I'm not sure it was a strike or not, so I'm going to let you take another pitch, and then I'll decide whether there was a strike
or not. Well, our view, and I think it's consistent, I think it's hard to read it otherwise from what this court wrote in Coalition, is that once the commission said, once the commission said you met your burden of proof this much and you failed to meet your burden of proof this much, that a party who fails to meet its burden of proof loses and the commission effectively disallows. So my understanding, the commission's understanding over these many years, is that the commission called a strike, and the remaining issue, as I indicated in footnote 7, is whether there is substantial evidence that the call was in a strike zone, if you will.
But the remainder of that footnote clearly says that we are not, as the dissent suggests, saying that this is an immediate penalty of $1.9 billion.
Absolutely.
It's clear from footnote 7 that the court did not think, my read of it, you left that sentence off.
It was not
an immediate disallowance.
But there's no doubt about that. There was not a permanent disallowance, and GSU has not taken a permanent write-off on this, because what remained was the important but necessarily limited question of whether the commission's finding that GSU failed to meet its burden of proof was reasonably supported by substantial evidence under the deferential charter medical standard. And that's the issue that the Court of Appeals grapples with and decides correctly. And we believe that that is what the court meant when it said that there isn't an immediate permanent disallowance, because the substantial evidence issue is left.
Does the PUC have the statutory power to hold aside a determination of this issue?
This court held that after the case has been brought to it and it's issued a decision, it cannot then decide to put off another issue. But I believe, if I recall, in a footnote that the court makes clear that it is not prohibiting the commission, and believes the commission has authority at an earlier stage to sever as may be appropriate earlier in the hearing before we get through 132 days of hearing, a 400-page examiner's report, and a commission call on what the evidence proves.
Before, Jay.
Yes.
Mr. Barron, do you agree with Mr. Hallis? This is not a case where the commission said, I don't want to hear that, we'll deal with it later. This is a case where everything was heard, and at the end, the commission said it couldn't make up its mind, and so it will just defer it till a later date.
Well, I agree up until that last point. I think certainly that
there's... Well, I mean, clearly the conclusion, I mean, a lot of this conclusion is some of the commissioners saying, well, you haven't proved prudence, but they haven't proved imprudence, and so we'll just defer it. I mean, there's some language in there.
There is language. It's mostly from final order meeting transcripts, which are not appropriately part of the record.
Assuming that's the case, this is a situation where you just had the decision maker refusing to rule. This isn't a case where they kept evidence from coming in that needs to be put before them.
I guess the $1.4 billion question is, when you say the commission refused to rule, is what is required for a ruling? We believe that this court held in Coalition that what is required for a ruling to make a final order is a ruling on whether GSU, it can be, on whether GSU met its burden of proof and that it did it this much and didn't.
Let's explore that a minute. You say it's a final order. If we left the order in place, untouched as it is today, the $1.4 some odd billion remains on the utility's books. It is not taken off the books and it would just remain there. The commission never made that call, did it? Saying that it's disallowed, you have to take it off the books, write it off.
No, but the commission, that's the utility's choice under the accounting rules. It is not the commission's call what to tell.
But the point of the order, the order was not final from that aspect. That's still up to the utility. But if we now, by your argument, we are changing the effect of the commission's order because we are saying, in fact, that it is a disallowance. The court, instead of the utility, instead of the PUC, is making the call that it is a disallowance.
I think that the question, though, is whether changing it, as you say, to making a permanent disallowance would have an effect on what the commission has the power to do. And GSU has argued that permanent disallowance would have an impact on financial integrity, which it doesn't elaborate on, but alleges that as distinguished to just keeping it on the books. We think that that is a fundamental misconception of what the financial integrity concept. Financial integrity is not a trump card that allows a utility to avoid proving the prudence of a case. The constitutional cases that are cited, none of them say that the Constitution guarantees financial integrity. I think that in the end...
I think you're missing. My specific question is not about all of the constitutional issues. If there had been a deferral, there had been a disallowance, GSU would have been required to write this off. It could not carry on its books. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's not the current effect of the PUC order.
The utility it's the utility's
doesn't
choice. That's right.
Doesn't it tell us that it's not
that's
a final
right.
order?
That's right. But the question that follows from that, Your Honor, is whether it makes a difference to the rates that the commission set because it would be a permanent disallowance. And you can only conclude that it would make a difference in the rates that are set if the commission has the power in the name of financial integrity to say, even though the utility failed to meet its burden of proof, we're going to allow higher rates to avoid the financial effects of the write-off. And if you consider the deferred accounting cases that you decided just 2 years ago, you held that in the name of financial integrity, the commission had the authority to allow a utility to engage in a deferred accounting practice to preserve, when necessary to financial integrity, to preserve the opportunity to recover costs. But the court understood, and all parties understood, that before those costs actually could come from the books and get in rate base, that there had to be proof by the utility that the costs were prudently incurred. And so financial integrity is circumscribed by and subject to the prudence call, and the prudence call is what we understand the court has construed our order to mean.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Judge Owen, if I could begin by trying to help you understand or get a response to your question about whether it's a final order or not in light of the company's failure to write off. That is an accounting convention. It is solely in the company's discretion. For instance, Texas Utilities Company, which had a disallowance of close to $1.4 billion, I forget the exact amount, that company in that situation chose to immediately write it off, the entire disallowance, in spite of the fact that it continued to go forward on appeal. And indeed, this commission and this court has recently considered the appeal of Texas Utilities case and has sent that back to the commission for reconsideration of some portion of that disallowance, which will mean that that company will get a windfall, in essence, money, it's already off its books, yet the money will come back to it if indeed the commission has to reconsider the minority owner buyback case in that Texas Utilities case. In this situation, Gulf States Utilities, even though it had a final order, rested on accounting convention and said, we don't have to write off this disallowance until we have exhausted our appeals. And so it has nothing to do with whether or not the order is final.
Well, there was no disallowance by the commission. Is there any conclusion of law in the order that says this is disallowed?
Your Honor, let me take you to conclusion of law 18. It states as follows. $1,453,520,982 of GSU's share of end-of-test year Riverbend capital costs should not be included from GSU's rate base as invested capital used and useful in rendering service to the public pursuant to PURA sections 38, 39, and 41. 18A then goes on to set the reasonable amount of that Riverbend investment that can come into rates. This commission had to make a final decision in order to set rates. The rates that were set included a disallowance of $1.453 billion. The error dealt with in Coalition of Cities is not as to the determination of that $1.453 billion, but rather what the commission wanted to do with that determination after the determination was reached. Let me take you to one financial integrity type point. I'll refer you to page 157A and 157B out of the examiner's report. I hold it up here just so you can see that it's a chart reproduced of GSU evidence. Now, I bring it to your attention for several reasons, because GSU put on financial integrity analysis and testimony before the commission of write-offs. And indeed, as you see the parties listed on this side, GSU was illustrating that there were three parties testifying before the commission that represented in their testimony and evidence that $1.4 billion ought to be written off. And GSU then goes on to present financial integrity analysis of what the result would be in light of that. So the commission had that testimony before it. And indeed, the commission, in its finding of fact 191, as referred to by Mr. Ratliff, indicates that a phase-in is not necessary given that the revenues generated by the rates, which included a $1.43 billion disallowance, were going to be adequate. And therefore, it was not necessary to give the company in that situation a rate moderation plan.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Council.
May it please the Court, Justice Holman, if I could, I think you're to the nub of the controversy, and that is, What the state is trying to say here is that the commission can make a, quote, reasoned judgment and enter a reasoned opinion in this case when they did not know at the time that they sought to defer that there was going to be a holding by this court that exceeded their power and, in fact, exceeded their power to such an extent that it would be subject to collateral attack. You're exactly right. The commission is the one that has to make that decision. And the reason that it has to make that decision is because, contrary to what we're used to in the trial court, the commission is charged by the statute with the duty to take into account the effect that its order may have on the utility and its ability to serve the public. That clearly was not done in this proceeding. Now, Mr. Gages took you to finding, to commission's finding 191, but he left out a part of it. And after it talks about that the rate moderation plan is not necessary, it says such a plan may be appropriate in the future if additional Riverbend capital costs are found to have been reasonably and prudently incurred. Similarly, I find it passing strange that we have the commission itself now saying that they had made a conscious decision to disallow in light of the language that they used on the motion for rehearing in Coalition of Cities, where they specifically said that the commission deliberately refused to make that disallowance decision in this document. Now, I think if you look at the order, and I think the extracts of the final order meetings that we handed to the court are instructive in this regard. And those final order meetings are incorporated in the order because the commission itself in this order says, for the reasons stated on the record in those meetings, we do thus and so. You go through it. Commissioner Graycock says everybody should be aware this is not a disallowance. Commissioner Campbell says we are not disallowing it. We are setting it to the side for a later determination. Chairman Thomas at that time dissents. He dissents on the basis that we should not hold this issue in abeyance. We should not defer.
Mr. Radlett,
yes, sir.
To get to the point you want this court to get to, and that is remand to the PUC for a prudency hearing.
Yes, sir.
What do we do with Coalition Cities?
I think what you do with Coalition Cities, Justice Gonzalez, is I think that it, all of this conversation about burden of proof, in my judgment, is beside the point of Coalition Cities, if I may be so bold as to say it. And the reason I say that is, once this court determined that the commission, by granting the severance, had so far exceeded its power that this court could intervene in a collateral proceeding and could uphold an injunction, I think the hunt was over. Once you decide that they have exceeded their power in attempting to set a second hearing.
So we would have to overrule Coalition Cities to some extent.
I think that you certainly would have to look at the burden of proof discussion and in my judgment, as being superfluous to the decision. Yes, sir. Because I think the fact of the matter is that you don't ever have to reach that question of burden of proof, because as this court well knows, once there's a determinant, once you're faced with an order that at least appears on its face to be final, and once it appears that it is deals with a subject matter which is not susceptible to separate treatment in two different proceedings, it seems to me that under Scurlock, you then have an order. To the extent you're going to apply res judicata and collateral estoppel principles to administrative orders, you then have an order that precludes a subsequent proceeding considering that same matter. It does not preclude a reversal and a remand in a direct attack such as this. But it occurs to me that some of the language dealing with burden of proof in Coalition, I think that the court may well have to simply distinguish it on the basis that it wasn't absolutely necessary to the decision. I don't believe it was. And I think the whole problem with Coalition is interpreted by the Third Court of Appeals. The whole problem is that, as Justice Owen has pointed out, you've got the court, either this court or the Court of Appeals or the District Court, making the determination that there's been a permanent disallowance. It is clear from the comments of the commissioners in the final order meeting that they understood the difference in impact on GSU of a permanent disallowance versus a deferral. It is also clear that they understood the financial situation that GSU found itself in at that time. So we believe that it is that the only appropriate order is to allow the commission itself to utilize its powers to determine what goes in the rate base and go ahead and make the findings on exclusion. We have a finding here, according to the respondents. We have a finding here made by somebody, a combination of the court and the commission, I suppose, that says does away with the entire 1.453B. When even the staff and the other witnesses for the intervenors would admit that a portion of that 1.453 had been prudently and reasonably incurred.
It troubles me a little bit, Mr. Ratliff, if at the end of the trial of the case, the judge says that I'm not sure whether you proved your case or not. So I'm just not going to decide that issue, but I'm going to render a judgment for X amount of dollars, which I can't calculate, but for the fact I don't include the number that I'm not sure whether you proved it or not, and just say, we'll go try that issue some other time. And now you've got a final judgment and it goes up on appeal. My concern is, what's the appellate function that's going on here? do you have the burden, if you had the burden of proof at trial, to prove the trial court erred in not awarding those damages? In other words, did the PUC err in not including that in the rate base? Or do you just send it back to the trial court to recalculate its judgment based on what it understands the MSB? I guess my concern is this. You've got a final decision here that has set rates, and that can't have been calculated but for the PUC adding some figures and subtracting some figures and that sort of thing. Right. In order to arrive at that, they clearly didn't include the $1.43 billion in their calculation.
That's correct.
Now, the argument, the point that's being made is they didn't include it because they say that Gulf States didn't show it was justified. We don't know. So we're just not going to allege it. We're saying, well, you can't defer that. You're going to have to decide it in this proceeding. We send it back to PUC. Is it to send it back to say Gulf States take a second shot at proving this case? I mean, is that what's going on here? GSC, you didn't prove it the first time. We'll give you a second shot to prove it. But doesn't that do violence with the Coalition of Cities, which says, PUC, you can't be in a rate case. You can't pick and choose what you're going to consider then and then put off for a future rate case stuff that should have been considered here.
I do not believe it necessarily means a second bite, and that's the reason I was trying to be careful in answering your questions before. I think it ought to go back to the Commission. If the Commission thinks they can make their decision on the basis of the record they currently have and can discharge their duty to the public as well as to GSU and to these parties, then I think that would be within the PUC's discretion. I think that's a part of their function. I think what happens in the situation you're talking about, and we have some close analogies, where the trial judge severs a cause and it is determined that he has severed a cause which is not severable. Well, you don't, in that case, simply take the evidence that was adduced on the severed cause and try to sort it out. What you do is you say on the direct appeal from that order, Your Honor, you didn't have the right to sever. And therefore, we're going to reverse this case. We're going to remand it to you. And admittedly, we're going to have to go back over some of the same ground. But you now are in a position to determine this appropriately with everything before you because you cannot sever. And I think that's the situation that we've got here, Your Honor.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in this clause and concludes the court's oral submission docket for the day. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.